This is Wallet Activism, a podcast for everyone ready to change the status quo using your financial power. I'm Tanya Hester. When we talk about activism through a financial or economic lens, most of the time people think of two things: shopping and investing. And those are important. I wrote a piece for Bloomberg last week about the expanding array of investment options that ethically minded folks now have, and I'll link to that in the show notes so you can check it out. But the single biggest financial decision we make is what we do for a living, our work. My guests today are my friends Kirsten and Julian Saunders, who I think are incredible role models for thinking about work, both doing work that aligns to your values and maintaining maybe the healthiest work-life balance I've seen among people whose work is fundamentally online. Kirsten and Julian Saunders are the creators of the Rich and Regular blog, the creators of the Money on the Table YouTube series that I can't recommend enough, hosts of the Rich and Regular podcast, money editors at Success Magazine, and now authors of the brand new book Cashing Out, which I got to read early and I loved it. I'm airing this interview now because Cashing Out is out today, and I encourage you to read it. Kirsten and Julian are also on Good Morning America today, so they don't need me to spread the word for them. But I know from personal experience that big media stories often miss the substance of your message, and these two have so much substance, as you'll hear in just a couple of minutes. There's strong pressure when talking about money to leave politics out of it, and as we know, just talking about being a person of color with money, or a woman with money, or a trans person with money feels to a lot of folks like a political act. Kirsten and Julian don't try to fit into that tidy little box for the sake of raking in sponsor money. And instead, they speak to the full Black financial experience, which I respect so much. Kirsten and Julian left their corporate jobs a few years ago to focus full-time on financial education for African-American audiences through their broad range of online and offline projects, all centered on the Rich and Regular brand. We started out the conversation talking about the need that they are trying to fill with their work.
I think the need that we're trying to fill is a cultural one. When you think back to how impacted people have been because of content, especially Black people, there's only a few pieces of content that we can all relate to that kind of changed the way we looked at family life, changed the way we looked at college with a different world, changed the way we looked at love with these movies like Love Jones, and changed the way we looked at parties like House Party. We all have these cultural staples, but what we're missing is an economic role model, a financial role model. And so what we're looking to do is do that in a modern way, which is using the power of the internet, the scale of the internet, to create financial content that features a real family going through real challenges, trying to raise a child, bootstrap a business, and survive in a systemically unjust world, and talk about, you know, how we manage our finances through all of that muck. And it's just a different way of trying to teach people and influence people to do the right thing instead of just forcing knowledge and definitions down their throat.
For those who've been paying attention, there's been a concept out there of Black excellence for a long time, and showing Black folks succeeding, African Americans doing incredible things. I'm going to actually let you define that because I don't want to speak for the Black community, but I know that you all have sort of a perspective on the good and the bad of that concept of Black excellence.
Yeah, we do. And I don't believe that it's a popular take at all. To your point, the term Black excellence is typically thrown around to celebrate not just those in the media that we see that are breaking new grounds and shattering ceilings, but I think even just for regular people or regular Black Americans out there, we sort of use that term as a source of strength and something that we rely on to get through the tough days at work. It's something that we identify with as something that we just remind ourselves of whenever like things get really, really tough. And that's great. But the problem is it also subscribes us or locks us into this identity and this requirement of having to be excellent at all times and at all things, and emotionally resilient no matter what is being placed on us. And we certainly identify with that in our professional lives and even in our entrepreneurial journey. But when we think about all the people that we know and we see that they kind of suffer from this sort of subscription to this idea, because they feel like they shouldn't be complaining, that they shouldn't be tired, or that they don't have time to rest because so much of what they are trying to do and so much of their family's needs and maybe even their community's needs rests on what they're doing. And so there's another side to it that we're asking people to confront a little bit and say, hey, we need to figure out simpler, less stressful ways to accomplish some of the things that we want to accomplish. And we may also want to look at letting go of excellence as an idea in some parts of our life and just trusting that there are others in our community that can carry that weight.
Yeah, I liken what we call anti-excellence to the body positivity movement. In the same way that young women and girls are taught that a size 6 body is the right body and you should, or size 2, depending on where you, what side of the country you live in, but that a certain size body is the right body and you should be at that weight or that size at all times, no matter what's going on, is an unfair proposition. And it only speaks to a certain amount of people. And it's not one that we created. It's a title that you're beholden to and oppressed by. And it's not something that we actually created that reflects our lived experiences. And so when we talk about Black excellence, we're just acknowledging that it's fine to use it as a rallying cry and as a method of encouragement. Black people have always taken words and ideas and constructs that were originally used to oppress them and made them positive. So it's fine to use Black excellence in that way as like a encouraging word, but it shouldn't be the standard. It shouldn't be the way that we live our lives, because it is a relic of white supremacy. It comes from being the good slave, the good Negro, the well-dressed and appointed one who, you know, white people would talk to. And it's not something that we have to do to recognize our humanity and to thrive as normal people.
I think about whenever a Black person is killed by police, it's always like here's all the ways they contributed to society. It's like, they could contribute nothing, and it's still horrible and not okay that that happened. And so I don't know if that's where your minds go with it, but, you know, hearing you, I think about that side of it.
Yeah, that's the premise of our brand, Rich and Regular, and people still have reactions to the word regular. They're like, I was always told not to be regular. I was always told, I don't want to be regular. I want to be rich and extravagant and awesome. And it's like, I mean, there are plenty of regular, awesome people. It's just a matter of deciding that you're not just one thing in general. We're all willing and able and should be allowed to experience all of the emotions and situations in life. And that's actually the goal. Being regular is the goal and the reward of financial independence if you're Black in America.
I'm sure that's going to resonate a lot with folks, that you shouldn't have to be excellent at all times to live a comfortable life and to be able to relax and do the things that you want to do. I think that's a really important message. And just thinking about like broader financial advice that, let's face it, is meant for white folks. It's never like you have to be the best entrepreneur in the whole world or the most outstanding case. It's just like, here are the few hacks. If you do these hacks, then you got it made.
That very much was at the spirit of or in the forefront of our minds as we were kind of thinking about what to call the brand, because we would see those things and we would say like, no, that's actually the goal, right? Like, I want to be that guy. Like, I don't even want to be top 100. It's like, giving us permission to just like relax a little bit. Cause I saw that was the biggest thing, is that so many of us like felt like in order to be successful, in order to be successful in their careers or whatever it is, they always felt like the need to go above and beyond, even though there was no real evidence to suggest that this was sustainable. And in fact, there was plenty of evidence showing that it wasn't. People burning out in their 30s and their 40s and relationships falling apart, not even being promoted or rewarded for your excellence at work. Yet here we are still sort of rallying behind this term. And so I found a lot of inspiration from our white brothers and sisters who I thought were quite mediocre at what they did, but were able to achieve like really great results. I was like, wow, you could be that. I was like, that seems like a relief.
Oh, that's so important. I think people really need to hear that. Speaking of your brand and what you all do, you have a book, you have an incredible video series, you have your blog, you have the magazine editing gig, shaping your whole career now and working together to focus on financial education and financial empowerment for Black folks. What is it that made you decide to shape your whole career that way instead of doing that as a volunteer gig or as a side hustle? There are so many different ways you could have done it that wouldn't be throwing everything at it. So what made you decide to take that big leap?
I think the reason we decided to go all in is because we recognize the stakes. The stakes are very, very high. We look at scary data that says the average or median net worth of Black Americans will be zero by 2053. And then when you add a pandemic on top of it, and you add digital illiteracy on top of it, and you add the likelihood that African Americans are going to be mostly impacted when automation becomes mainstream, it just made us feel the same way that climate activists feel when there are hurricanes that cross over land and affect two states, right? It's alarming. And we have that much of a view at it every day. It's not removed from us. It's not, you know, a reminder that pops up every time another Black person is killed by police. It is every day talking to our friends and family who are doing really well, but are not preparing for their future. We thought the right thing to do, if we believed as strongly as we do about the methods and the tactics that we talk about, that we should do everything possible to make those accessible to anybody who wants to learn it.
I would also say we have had the pleasure of sort of straddling two different worlds. Like, we're very much a part of the Black community, but because of our interests in connections to other worlds, particularly like the financial independence and personal finance and media world, which is predominantly white, we've had the ability to sort of act as a bit of a bridge. And we would, again, see all of these different variations of success in the world outside of Black America. And we would see all these new ideas and all these new platforms and approaches to building wealth and starting businesses. And then when we would look inward and look in our communities, like, it was like just a completely different world. Like, you did not hear about any of those things or see any of them. And going back to the idea of like the different variations of success, like, we just didn't see that. And so we really wanted to help repackage some of those things and say, hey, these are some of the things that we're seeing over here. What does that look like, or what could that look like for our community or for us? And at the time, it was really kind of simple. I mean, my corporate career was largely spent in marketing and branding. Kirsten's was in partner marketing and in business development. And we're pretty comfortable financially. And I said, you know, if we're going to want to have an impact on our community, given how high the stakes are, like, we really have an interesting and intriguing opportunity to try to do that, particularly given the cultural relevance of being in the city of Atlanta. So just kind of felt like all the stars were aligning. We were in Atlanta, which is such a cluster of Black wealth in this country. We were at a certain point in our careers where we had developed these skills that we knew that if we'd sort of invested in ourselves and invested in building something on our own, that we might be able to not only build a lifestyle that supports us financially, but also create the kind of change in our community that we just weren't seeing. And certainly we're not seeing other people in the finance community or businesses sort of catering to. And so we felt like instead of relying on other people to cater to our community, we realized that we just needed to be the people that could lead that work.
Prefacing this question with the knowledge that in this patriarchal white supremacist society, people are always going to make certain assumptions about who things are for. If you're a white dude writing a book, people assume it's for everyone. If you're me, you write a book, people assume it's for women. If y'all are doing stuff, there are going to be certain folks who assume that it's for Black folks. Putting that aside as much as we can, in making the choice to specifically speak to African Americans about finance rather than targeting a broader audience, what trade-offs do you think you've had to make, or what cost has there been to you in going down that road of saying, okay, we are going to be very, very targeted because we have this purpose and mission, but certainly that has a financial trade-off as well?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a financial trade-off. There's been a growth trade-off. I think most people are familiar with the algorithms and the way that Black content is distributed on social media, which is what we use to get our message out there. And so growth has been significantly slower than if we had taken a different approach and maybe been anonymous, or taking the same great content that we write and create and ghostwritten it under someone who looked different's name. We acknowledge that, and we chalk that up as the cost of doing business. For us, it was really important. It was more important for people to know upfront that we were Black and that we were regular, and that, you know, we were doing this at first at the same time as we were doing a normal 9-to-5 job. And so we've traded off speedy viral growth for a longer, steadier, more intimate relationship with our audience. And I think there's a financial trade-off as well. I mean, I think there are some brands who prefer to keep, I'm using air quotes, politics or racial discussion out of their ambassadors or influencers' timelines. And so if you come to our timeline and do a couple of scrolls, it's very easy to see that we have opinions about things and that we share our perspective often. So I can imagine that has taken us off the list of several brand partners and people we wouldn't mind working with, but like aren't aligned to our values or we're not aligned to theirs.
I can't imagine that's not true, because just existing in a non-white male body makes you political, according to a lot of folks. Given that you're doing this purpose-driven work and it clearly means a lot to you, but you're also staking the well-being of your family on it, you have a child to provide for and all the things that go with paying for life, have you had to make any compromises?
Oh, 100%. And that's a really great question. You know, that's difficult. But even aside from just like having to work with companies that may not necessarily be perfectly aligned with our value system, even just our at-home life, you know, and having to constantly juggle between the needs of our business and the needs of our family, you know, and granted, that's not something that's unique to us, but like, it's certainly been a hell of a challenge. You know, this is the icky part or the mucky part of capitalism. And certainly if like, I think growing a business or a platform, none of these systems or platforms are perfect. And so every single day that you choose to engage or even use a existing distribution platform to communicate with your audience, you are in some way in agreement or in bed with a partner that you may not necessarily be perfectly aligned with or in agreement with. And that could just be like for that particular day or for a particular season or just in general. We try our best to stick to our guns, and we've certainly turned down some things that we just knew just would not sit well with us. And to Kirsten's point, though, like, this is also the benefit of being in a financially comfortable decision, right? You can pick and choose which partners or where you draw the line, you know, and say, hey, you know what? We don't need the money, and we certainly don't need it so bad that we'd be willing to collaborate with this type of partner in order to help fund an objective or reach more people or something like that. But we've certainly had those experiences, you know, but I think we've done a pretty good job of building a brand that actually doesn't even attract some of those people. They still sort of come knocking every now and then, but I think we're so clear on who we're serving and what we're about that I think a lot of those companies and organizations or even people don't even bother knocking on our doors because we don't look or feel or sound like people who would prioritize earning an extra dollar over their beliefs.
Just curious if you can share a bit with us about your decision-making process. Have you put together sort of a, you know, here's where the line is, or here's how we make a choice about that?
It's kind of more art than science, but it is looking at their track record. So a standard Google search, looking at the company, what their beliefs are, looking at their board, looking at their social media to see if there are Black faces and people of color represented. Looking at their website, because for us, we're always imagining from our user's perspective. So if we try to introduce you to this basket making company and you get all excited about your new basket, but you go to their website and it's completely whitewashed or the language doesn't acknowledge the uses you have in mind for your basket and all of their how-to is talking about using the basket in a way that you're completely unfamiliar with, then we know that that sale isn't going to close. And it was kind of a waste of our time and our users' time because we sent them down this path that doesn't lead them to more utility or happiness or success in any way. And so it's really just kind of going through the user experience and then also looking at the brand itself to make sure that it's a company that is reliable and dependable. It's going to be here for a while. It doesn't just look like a scheme or a scam.
I think there are two other layers to that, though. There's also just the experience with the agent. So whoever the person is that is reaching out to us, and we're grateful that as professionals, we've had a good bit of experience in dealing with people of all different, you know, backgrounds. And we can kind of get a sense for what they're looking for or what they see in us, either from the note that they send or the conversations that we're having or what they're asking us to do. And so you can get a sense for that as well. There are a couple of things that are also pretty cut and dry, which is, does this organization or company have a track record of being predatory or having a negative impact on the community that we serve, right? And so there are some companies and industries that where we just flat out draw the line. It doesn't matter what you ask me to do. Like, we have absolutely no interest in doing those things. And I would say similarly, there are ways of earning money that we've just deliberately said, yeah, we're just not going to do that because it just doesn't feel right. And we actually feel like it is a pool of predatory behavior that negatively impacts the community that we're trying to serve. And I think just works contrary to the beliefs and the mission that we're trying to fulfill. But even today, right, in the aspect of growing our business, there's a tendency to be adjacent to some of these really fuzzy areas. And I think particularly with the Black community, because this is where we're focused on, like, we are being bombarded with crypto experts and Forex experts and MLM companies. Like, they are truly dominating content and messaging, and as a result, shaping what's possible for our community. And they're doing it really, really well. Right? Because in some cases, they can get to the highest of levels and are partnering with even celebrities or celebrity platforms, and then using that as a bullhorn to promote these types of messages. And so when you come in with a more pragmatic and well-researched or simple, dare I say, approach to accomplishing some of these objectives, because they don't have nearly as much appeal as the sizzle reel that they heard at this conference or this seminar or on this massively popular YouTube channel, you sort of get drowned out. And so in part, what we're trying to do is to create content that breaks through that noise and hopefully reaches people that have the ability to discern, like, what's real, what's realistic, and what also, dare I say, might not require you to, like, be sketchy and do things that, like, force you to take advantage of other people or just risk all of your lifetime's earnings just for the opportunity to make a quick buck.
All right. So we've talked a lot about the trade-offs and some of the harder parts of it, but I'd love to hear too, honestly, watching the work that you two do, the videos especially, and the talks that you give, it looks like you're having a blast. And I'm sure that that's not the whole story, but there's obviously a huge upside to all this. So I'd love to hear about that. You know, it feels like it's got to be more creative, more fun in some ways, nice to not have a boss. And what's the good part of striking out on your own and doing this work?
There's a lot of good. I think the first one is ownership. We have been able to take an idea and transform it into an asset, which is a superpower. And it feels incredible. And this is what wealth creation, in my mind, is going to look like in the 21st century and beyond. It's going to be people who can do things that robots can't do, which is tell stories and create compelling content. So that is one of the benefits, is the ownership piece. We've gone through the lens to protect our intellectual property and make sure that we truly own it. And so it's an asset that we've created. I think another benefit is just the ability to work together in new ways. Like, it's challenging, but there is a lot of fun in that, and in seeing your partner lead in a different way than you would have in, like, a corporate setting, or even that you see in, like, the day-to-day, just watching, you know, your partner show up for work differently and bringing their full self to the job. And there's no filter or hesitancy or worry that you're going to be penalized for having an idea that's different and bold and innovative.
I would say for me, one of the biggest benefits, and I'll be specific because I'm thinking about our video series, Money on the Table, is that in this particular season, like, we weren't just focusing on ourselves. We weren't just trying to retell our story or our positions on any number of subjects. We were actually using our platform to amplify other people in the space that we thought were doing good work. And so going back to what I was saying before about really trying to combat a lot of the noise that's out there that we think is largely distracting and doing a disservice to our community, what we wanted to do is to say, all right, give them something that they can't take their eyes off of and lead them to a few trusted sources. And in addition to that, with this particular season, because we're overachievers, we found a way to incorporate supporting Black businesses along the way. And so for me, the fact that in this particular season, we were able to highlight three of the country's best Black chefs is a huge highlight for me. Black restaurants, bakeries, wine shops, and et cetera. Like every single one of these are being featured and getting high quality assets that they did not have before that they can then use to help grow their business and hopefully attract more customers. And so for us, it was like a win-win-win. We get to be collaborative and creative. We get to amplify people in the space that we thought were doing great work. And on top of that, we get to celebrate and showcase, I think, more realistic success stories of people who are doing great in their jobs and also like as entrepreneurs.
I love that. I'm curious in making the choice to share the mic. You know, we definitely live in this influencer culture, and I'm personally not a fan of that term because I think it's often used to belittle what people are doing. And sure, if people are just saying, here are my outfits, you know, on Instagram, maybe that's a fair use for influencer. But a lot of folks who I see are doing important activism work or like the incredible work that you're doing. I think calling you an influencer is not giving enough credit to the thought that goes into it, the preparation, all the hard work that you do. But still, in this world, you know, to publish a book, you need a platform, and publishers want to see that you have a certain number of followers or a certain level of prominence. And I think there is a lot of pressure to keep the focus on yourself and to try to build your own brand. And so I'm curious, what was it that let you feel comfortable saying, okay, either we've achieved a certain level and now we can start to pass the mic and highlight others, or we don't even care what level that is. We just want to do this because it's important. Like, what helped you get to that decision?
All of the influencers that I had followed in the past, I was watching them get burnt out. I was seeing them suffer from debilitating anxiety, being attached to their phone, never being present. And I knew I didn't want that life for myself. And so I knew as the brand grew, I couldn't continue to center myself, my experiences, my life at the forefront of the brand. It needed to be a bigger idea. It needed to be like a lifestyle that more people felt like they could take place. Whether or not you're a Black girl from the South and married with a kid versus LGBTQ or child-free by choice or single or Latina or even white. Like I needed Rich and Regular to be a concept that people felt like they could grab a hold of without it being like, I want to be like Kirsten.
It's about picking the type of life that we wanted to lead, and we're mature enough, old enough to be able to look back and say, well, how did that end, right? And so as much as it could be tempting to say, wow, if we just published 5 times a day and danced and did all the things that we needed to do on social media, that we could make $1 million in a year, be wildly successful. But like, that's not what life is about, right? Like for us, it's about saying, well, who are they 5 years from now, 10 years from now? I remember when we first wrote our ambition, I wouldn't call it a business plan, but we really weren't even creating content for the audiences so much. We were creating it for ourselves. Then we said, yeah, if anything, we want to be the people that all of those people who center themselves at the heart of everything that they do, we want to be their fave. Right. We want to be the people. You know, I'm a hip hop head. Right. So there's this term that they call like a rapper's rapper. You know what I mean? It's like, who do they wish they could be because they're so tired of always being the character that they've created? And what we wanted to create was that. And the best way to do it is to just be yourself. And so we've just been studying that entire, not just industry, but lifestyle, and saying, well, that is a short-term gain, and we see it. And you probably have a short list of people in your mind right now that are constantly active despite the warnings, despite the trends, despite what we know this does to you psychologically. But, you know, the stakes are higher for us. It's not about us. It's about our community. It's about our family. And so if that means that we're going to be largely absent, and if that means that we are going to have a smaller following and maybe sacrifice revenue or earning potential, we're okay with that because, like, we're good. We've not built a life that is so obsessed with earning money or maximizing wealth potential. Those aren't the only indicators that we use to measure success.
Well, I mean, to that end, I think it comes through loud and clear in the work that y'all put out, that you have a very balanced view of what's actually important in life and that you're not just chasing the buck and trying to maximize every little thing. But to what you just said, what does a successful life look like to you? What are the indicators that you use?
For me, a successful life looks like one that largely takes place in real life. And so we all have these digital personalities and these digital relationships and connections, but I also have the ability to have dinner with a real live person should I want to. So it's a balanced approach of like friends that are accessible and family that's accessible versus people I just know from the internet. It's content creation that's done with integrity and nuance. And so there is a strong pull to create a bunch of memes and internet-friendly shorthand. But I really like living in the world of nuance and wisdom, which is kind of where we sit. And then it's also being able to meet and attract people and brands from the work that we do that reduces the ability to have to like hard sell everybody on everything. Like I want to create the kind of content where people are just like fans of it. I even hate the term followers. I just want you to be a fan of my content. And if we happen to sell something that like, you're such a fan of our work that you'll buy it. I don't have to like give you all the urgency messaging and the 3 mile long sales page and the, you know, in your face with the, hey, huge announcement 3 days before it comes out. Like, sure, I'll do some of that because algorithms, but for the most part, I don't want to feel like I have to do that every single quarter or every single week.
Yeah. And for me, I think at the risk of sounding cliche, the word impact is at the forefront of my mind in terms of like what a successful life looks like. And more recently, that's looked like being able to share the mic and turn down a media inquiry and give it to someone that I think could really use it because they have something unique and valuable to say, or it might be missing in the space. That was done for me. And quite honestly, Tanya, you did that for us. And so for us, I found it to be incredibly fulfilling to be able to be at a point where I could say, no, I don't need another CNBC mention at all. Right? Like, I don't even believe I've added all of them to my press page. And so what would be the value in me just giving another quote? Why not use that to promote somebody else who I think has something just as, if not more valuable or important to say? But I think the other thing in terms of impact is talking about, like, as much as we are in the sort of personal finance world, is talking a little less about money in the way that money is normally spoken about and talking about all the things that money impacts. And particularly for us over the last year, it's about relationships and parenting and how your financial life impacts all of those things. And we don't like to think, for example, that money has much of an impact on your ability to be a good son or a good daughter. But that's something that I've actually really realized is really, really important as I struggle with helping my mom to, you know, she's getting a knee replacement and she's going to need someone to help take her to get the surgeries and to rehab and to do all of these different things. Or even as she's wrestling with how she's going to continue to nurture relationships with her siblings in New York or in Florida, and she can't afford to go down and see them. And so all of these things, I think, are just as important as deciding a stock allocation or what's the best way to sort of save on taxes. I think those types of things dominate personal finance media as opposed to the things that I believe really matter, which is like how money shows up in your life, the impact that it has on your ability to create positive change. And again, not even like, I'm not even talking about the environment. I'm just talking about in your household. You know, let's just start there. And so that's part of what we're trying to do. And so, yeah, that's how I'm defining success, is like knowing that we've helped more couples stay together because they finally got over the hump and had a conversation, a transparent conversation about money and their habits, or helping someone think through a career choice as they're wrestling with between who they envision themselves in the future, but also like what their income potential may be for that particular career, like having the time to sit with them and give them some alternatives so that they can actually, you know, make a well thought out decision. Those are the things that I think define success. And so the fact that we're in a position where we can do that and be that, whether it's like directly because we know you and we can carve out an hour to have that conversation, or because we've created a piece of content that focuses on the impact of growing a side hustle. I'm literally thinking of a specific episode right now. How to navigate the emotional valleys and peaks of, I have an idea, it's now a side hustle, but do I take the leap and go all the way in? Like, we're presenting that conversation with two families that I think a lot of people will be able to relate to, right? They're not these mega multimillionaire. I made $10 million with a course overnight and you can do it too. It's more like, hey, I've got a barbecue company and it's doing pretty well. What do you think I should do? You know, and I think that is just far more realistic and impactful. And so, yeah, that's what we are much more focused on trying to amplify and share these days.
Is there a small bookstore you'd love to shout out that you'd love people to pre-order or buy your book from?
Yes, it is Fulton Street Books and Coffee, located in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We actually just filmed one of our episodes of Money on the Table there. It's a small, Black-owned, highly curated bookstore that's there. I had a really meaningful breakthrough while we were in Tulsa that there are these places and events in Black history where the only thing that people think about is the historical relevance. But the reality is there are business owners and people who are trying to rebuild a legacy that need customers. And so I am planning to send everybody and buy my future books from this particular bookstore. And it's a great way to browse Black stories and Black authors and creators that you may not find in your big box retailer, but are there because the owner is very intentional about making sure that they're there.
For folks who are looking to be better wallet activists in some way, in any way, whether it's through the work they do or how they're volunteering or the choices they're making, what's a good resource you'd recommend for them?
You know, with questions like this, I always tend to look for a book that's adjacent to the topic, but covers the emotional role modeling that you need to tackle something like wallet activism. And so the book I would recommend is A Long Walk to Freedom by Nelson Mandela. It's his autobiography about all of what he went through in South Africa and apartheid. And I think it's a great example of leadership and facing what feels like overwhelming levels of conflict and staying the course. And so finding inspiration in his story and in his words is probably what I would recommend first, and then move on to the tactics, because you're going to need that emotional fortitude to make them sustainable and long-term and, you know, countercultural as they are right now.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. That's a wonderful and hard and inspiring book. But yes, absolutely. We need to know those stories and to develop that empathy so that, as you said, we can stick with the tactical pieces. Well, Kirsten and Julian Saunders, thank you so much for the work that you do, and thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us. This was a great conversation.
Thank you.
Kirsten and Julian are so inspiring, don't you think? I have jokingly referred to financial independence as entrepreneurship for wimps, because it's a whole lot easier to experiment with the work you're doing when there are no financial stakes. When you're already financially comfortable, it's honestly the only way I have been able to write books. But Kirsten and Julian didn't wait to make the leap to working for themselves until they were fully work optional, to borrow my first book's title. They still have to work. And they could have stayed in those cushy corporate jobs and been on track to retire early in their 40s, but they chose to follow their hearts instead and do this important work, and I have such enormous respect for that. Some of my biggest takeaways from the conversation were the compromises you sometimes have to make to do values-aligned work, and I definitely felt the part about having to engage on social media platforms that you know do harm in the world. For anyone who does online work now, you don't really get a choice about that. That's definitely true for authors. The platform that you have is really a big part of publishers agreeing to publish your work, and that means being on social. I also loved hearing their decision-making process on who to work with, and I loved hearing the good parts. I was so struck by the point that entrepreneurship not only gives them the freedom to work for themselves, but also the freedom to lift as they climb, and the effort they've made to support Black chefs and Black-owned culinary businesses. I really loved that. Though we didn't focus on their book in the conversation, I suspect you've now gotten enough of a sense of Kirsten and Julian Saunders to know that their book, Cashing Out, is full of solid, real-world advice. They're not going to push you into crypto or an MLM or convince you that you can get rich quick. As I said in my blurb on the back of the book, it's rare to find a solid personal finance guide that's so full of love. Kirsten and Julian never make you feel bad for your past choices and show you a clear path full of doable action steps. And I really mean that. So everything we've talked about today is linked in the show notes. You can check it out there. And if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend or recommend it on one of those evil social networks that we all use anyway, even though we hate them. It always means a lot to me if you leave a review, but I'm not going to lie to you and pretend like that's going to help the show climb up the rankings or anything like that. It doesn't work that way. As always, Wallet Activism is ad and sponsor free now and forever. The best way to support the show or show your appreciation is to buy a copy of my book, Wallet Activism, available wherever books are sold, and of course, in ebook and audiobook versions. And I have a post up on the blog today on how you can buy ebooks and audiobooks without having to shop from Amazon. If you have questions or want to chat about something you heard today, you can tweet at me or message me on Instagram. On both platforms, I'm at @our_next_life. Make sure you're subscribed to the show on your podcast player of choice so you don't miss new episodes. And until next time, remember, you have real power.